Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
Hello there, lovely to be with you. Now, I don't know about you, but I just adore the sound of frogs. Suppose for me, that's one of the sounds of my childhood. Gumboots on, hunting for frogs in the enormous creek that wound through the front of the Perth Hills property where I grew up. If I'd been any good at science, I'd probably be out researching the mating habits of frogs right now, rather than here chatting to you. But in preparing for today's show, I learnt that I actually don't need a Bachelor of Science to be doing that. It's all thanks to citizen science, where everyday people, just like you and me, are able to go out into the natural environment around us and collect information for scientific research programs. Most of the time, all you need is your phone camera and a keen interest in the world around you. Don't like frogs? No stress. There are projects to track almost anything from birds, whale sharks, dead trees, dolphins, even manta rays. Citizen science projects are popping up all over the world. It's Science Week, so let's explore how they work, how you can get on board, and if they're the way of the future. And I would love to hear from you. Are you involved in a citizen science project? What is it? What are you tracking? 1300 222 720 is the number you can give me a call on, or you can send me a text 0437 922 720. With me today, Paul Doughty, WA Museum's man all about frogs, really. He's involved with the Frog ID program, which is Australia's first national frog identification program done through an app. We've also got Paul Flemons. He's from the Australian Citizen Science Association. So two Pauls, not to confuse you. And Tegan Douglas, WA Citizen Science Project Coordinator. And she's also with BirdLife Australia. Paul Flemons, let's start with you. What are the different ways people can get involved in citizen science?
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me on the show. Well, let's define citizen science first. It's the public participation and collaboration in scientific research for increasing scientific knowledge. Well, that's the Australian Museum's definition of it. I work for the Australian Museum, and I'm here representing the Australian Citizen Science Association. So there's various ways to classify types of citizen science and levels of engagement that citizen scientists can have in citizen science projects. And my favourite one involves four different levels, which grade from citizens as sensors, so crowdsourcing, where they're using their mobile phones, as you mentioned, for Frog ID, etc., to record and submit data. There's in distributed intelligence, where citizens are interpreting information, such as online transcription requiring interpretation and research. An example of that is Digivol, an Australian Museum online transcription project. There's participatory science, which is citizen scientists being involved in the problem definition and data collection, and that's designing and undertaking surveys. And the museum ran a project, an expedition called Bald Pyramid Expedition, a couple of years ago, in which we had volunteers helping in designing and undertaking the surveys. And then the fourth level is extreme citizen science, which is really about the citizen scientists being collaborative with research institutions such as the Australian Museum in the problem definition, data collection and analysis. And they're defining the conservation goals, for example, and working on producing outcomes. And the museum has been working with the Quayo people of the Solomon Islands in helping them do community-driven conservation in the Solomon Islands.
So plenty of ways we can get involved. I like the sound of extreme citizen science. Paul Doughty, let's bring you in here. You already know I love frogs. Tell us about your Frog ID citizen science project.
Well, it all runs through this GWiz app that's been developed by the Australian Museum and IBM. So you can download the app on your phone and then just go frogging. So the great thing about frogs and the way this app works is that frogs are on the surface, they're projecting their sound, and you don't have to get that close to them to be able to capture the sound. Also with this sort of interaction of frog and human, you don't have to touch the frog either. You don't have to fall in the pond and drop your phone in the water.
That's either. No fun then. Not as fun as I liked it as a kid.
So yeah, it's a great way to sort of capture the sound of the frog. So you don't have to know anything about frogs before you start. So one of the filters you can put in is, okay, where I am. So let's say we're at ABC Studios, and that'll call up a bunch of swan coastal plain species, and then we'll ask further questions. Is it a permanent water body? Is it a little soaky area? Where are you? And through that, it'll finally come up with a list of options, and it'll come up with a species and the sound of that call, the calls of the different options. And then you listen to it and you go, not that one. It's like, oh yeah, it's that one. So then you input that, and then that gets sent away, and Jody in Sydney or Stephen, experts will actually listen to the calls. So Jody and Stephen have cracked the 100,000 mark of the calls.
Oh, round of applause. That's an amazing achievement.
I think Jody's might be going slightly mental listening to all these calls, but she likes them. And then you'll get a reply back. Validating your call, you know, a thank you saying, yep, it's this, or maybe try again if you're too far away or something like that. So that's a way your citizen scientist can get some feedback from an expert.
All right. And what have you learnt from all this data that you've collected so far?
Well, there has been a mountain of data, and Jody and I have a date in the future sometime to sit down and make sense of it all.
A frogger's date? Is that what they call them?
We'll get together either here or there and try to make sense of it, because it's the timing of the year that frogs call, because there's generally a bread and butter time for the males and the females doing all the breeding, but often the males will be a little bit optimistic and call outside of the main sort of area just in case. There's also a lot of male-to-male interactions that will get picked up outside of the main breeding time. So we're interested in all that sort of stuff.
Give me a rough translation then, in terms of a human translation, for what are the frogs saying when they're doing those calls?
Well, basically there's two elements to a frog call, I guess. So it's the male that makes the call. So one part of it is, you know, hey, ladies, come check me out. You know, I've got what you want. The other part is
a bit more Kermit the Frog style then, yeah?
Yeah, well, Kermit's so innocent. And then the other part is bugger off, this is my patch, go call somewhere else. So there's a bit of male-male sort of aggro going on there, and there's a bit of spacing. And if all of a sudden a male starts calling next to another male, then things get really excitable, and then there might be some little sumo wrestling. That's how frogs duke it out. If you can see some videos. So there's that sort of two elements to the call.
Let's bring in someone whose name isn't Paul. Tegan, tell us about your project with birds.
So one of the fantastic things about birds is that they're around us every day. And, you know, people say, oh, no, look, Tegan, don't be so silly. Have a think this morning. As you woke up, when your alarm went off, what was one of the first noises that you heard?
Oh, they were going crazy out the front.
Regardless of where you are in Australia, you can live in the middle of the city, you can live in the remotest part of the outback, and you are surrounded by birds. One of the most important things that we can do to help conserve birds is to figure out where they are and how their populations are doing. And there are so many people out there who have an eye in for birds in their space or love to go travelling to look at birds. And so what BirdLife Australia asks is that we try and get people on board with recording what they see when they see it in a whole range of different projects.
How long, Tegan, has BirdLife been using citizen scientists to help?
Well, BirdLife itself, we're Australia's oldest conservation organisation. We've actually been around since 1901.
Wow.
But we've probably been doing citizen science since the late 70s. So in the late 70s, actually prior to that, we did not have a sense of where all the birds of Australia were found. Most of the records that we had were from people in museums collecting specimens, but we had no idea. So we had these little pins on the map, but Australia's a big continent. So we put together this project called the Atlas of Australia's Birds and asked people to go out on every grid cell across the country and record birds. And people, citizen scientists, everyday people stepped up and did that. And so for the first time, we had this fantastic record of where across the country at different times of year our native birds could be found.
Tell me about some of the main projects that may be familiar to some of the listeners.
Sure. Probably one of the ones that Perth people will be most familiar with is possibly the Great Cocky Count. So that's run every year in April. And what we do is we ask people to donate an hour of their time to go to a designated spot that we either know or we suspect that our beautiful black cockatoos come in to roost at night, and ask them to stand there for an hour around sunset and count the birds as they come in. And we get sort of, you know, 700-800 people registered, and we usually have about 1,100 people participate each year. And that is, it's actually one of the main ways that we're able to track the conservation status of our three black cockatoo species. So it's all people power.
We're going to hear all about the Lord Howe Island phasmid in a minute, but Barry from Melville has called in. He is a citizen scientist. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Jess.
What do you do?
How do you do? Yeah, look, I used to, when I was a young fellow, I lived in a little country town called Wickapin. Hello, Wickapin, how are you going? My father was a police officer there, and right next to the police station there was a creek called Yarling Brook that ran along. And I heard about the museum wanting frogs for dissection, I think. I don't think they wanted for frog legs or fried frog legs or anything. So
you hope?
Yeah, I hope, yeah. So what I did, I got Dad to make me a box. Well, he suggested it, actually. We got a box, an old fruit case, and we put a bit of bird wire over the top. And I'd fill it up with the clay, excuse me, from along the bank of the creek. And then I'd go along and I'd dig these frogs out early in the morning when they'd just reburied themselves in the side of the bank. And I'd get 20 or 30 or whatever frogs, put them in there, fasten the wire down, put them in a wheelbarrow, wheel it across to the railway station, and it'd go down on the train. It was all arranged, you know, and the museum would come and pick them up and take them away, and they'd send me back an envelope with however many stamps, you know, say a penny a frog, and if I had 20, I'd get 20 stamps back.
Wow.
Penny stamps. And I'd take the stamps across to the postmaster and he'd change them back into coin.
Barry, that is a beautiful story.
And later in life, I became I was a diver, and then I became a commander in Easy Rescue. And I collected specimen fish, or specimen marine life, if you like, around some of the islands in the Indian Ocean, and sent them. I used to put them in, I think it was formalin. They'd go into formalin and then be flown down here to the museum for research purposes and identification and so forth.
Barry, that is fantastic. It's lovely to hear that there's citizen scientists out there that have been doing this for a long time, like yourself. Thanks for sharing that story. Paul Flemons, let's bring you back in here. Before we get to why they're so important, what does a Lord Howe Island phasmid actually look like?
What do they look like? Well, they're kind of most stick insects you think of, people think of long, skinny things with really long, spindly legs. Lord Howe Island stick insect, or phasmid as it's known, is quite fat and jet black, looks a bit like a pair of patent leather shoes, very shiny and black, in the shape of a sausage, I guess, with legs.
So it's the insect equivalent of a dachshund.
That's not a bad description, actually. A very shiny black dachshund, yeah. Yep.
All right. What's so important about this Lord Howe Island phasmid?
Well, it was on Lord Howe Island for millennia, I guess, and then in the about the 1920s, there was a shipwreck on Lord Howe Island, and some rats escaped onto Lord Howe Island. And over the following 10 or 20 years, they made the stick insect on Lord Howe Island extinct. And so it was thought that the Lord Howe Island phasmid was extinct from Earth altogether. And then people started climbing Ball's Pyramid, which is a sea stack near Lord Howe Island, about 20 kilometres away. And it's a magnificent piece of rock, like something it's just a magnificent sort of...
Be like Lord of the Rings or something.
Lord of the Rings, sorry. Yeah, that was what I was looking for, yeah. And in the early 2000s, some scientists were there doing some... looking for what they could find on Ball's Pyramid, and they actually found the stick insect there. And... they found it on a bush in the lower part of Ball's Pyramid, and they thought, oh, that was the first time it had been seen in 60-something years. And so it was an extinct insect was suddenly not extinct anymore, and it's called the rarest insect in the world because it only occurs on Ball's Pyramid now. And 2 years ago, the Australian Museum, led by myself, ran an expedition out there to look on Ball's Pyramid to see if it was common on Ball's Pyramid, or was only found on that particular bush on the lower part of Ball's Pyramid.
What did that project involve? That a citizen science project like that sounds pretty extreme.
Pretty hair raising, yeah. So it was. We needed to engage climbers who had a lot of experience and were able to climb in extreme situations. And so we engaged a team of six volunteer climbers, citizen science climbers, and they actually went through the process of designing the whole survey with us. They worked out how we get onto Ball's Pyramid, how to climb it, because we wanted to survey all over Ball's Pyramid, not just in those areas that are easy to reach. And being such an inaccessible rock, it requires very skilled climbers to do that. And so over a period of 8 nights and 8 days, these six climbers, who varied in age from about 49 to 70. So two of the climbers were 69 and 70. But as they said to me when I was talking to them in the beginning and asking what they were capable of, they said, well, there are bold climbers and there are old climbers, but there are no old bold climbers. So that convinced us that these people were the right people for the job. And they were incredible in their ability to support a scientific project and help us reach our goal, which was to bring back stick insects for the breeding program down at Melbourne Zoo, and also to identify that the stick insects do occur all over Ball's Pyramid, which has significant implications for the efforts to reintroduce them to Lord Howe Island itself, where they're currently running a rat eradication program, which will mean the environment is then suitable for reintroducing the stick insects back onto Lord Howe Island, where they were originally from.
So, sorry, how many did they get while they were on this big Ball's Pyramid expedition?
Okay, so because it's a threatened species, we were only allowed to bring back one stick insect for every 10 that we saw. Now, previously there'd been 40 seen on individual plants, but there'd been a pretty bad drought before we went out. And so we only found 17 overall, spread all over the Ball's Pyramid. And because we'd only found 17, we could only bring back one, but that was a female. And so we took the female down to Melbourne Zoo, and it was involved in the breeding program down there.
So presumably was that intentional, to bring back the female that was...
Yes, yeah. So we found males and females, but we decided to bring back a female, and she laid eggs when she got down to Melbourne Zoo, and so that was a success in that respect.
Fantastic. Okay, let's bring the non-Paul back in here, Tegan Douglas. It is confusing when we have two Peters, as I said yesterday, two Pauls today. Who knows what tomorrow could look like? Tegan, a couple of texts have come in already, and this one is a question. Other than roadkill, why do I never see dead birds around the place, says Joe?
It probably has a little bit to do with where you live. The thing is, we have, when you look at the birds that we have out there, there are a whole range of ages and health conditions and things. If you have a really healthy bird community, that also includes a really healthy cleanup crew. So if there's something that has fallen off the perch, for want of a better phrase, there's going to be some, oh no, I'm going to do it again. There's going to be some eagle-eyed bird out there who is going to spy that free meal.
This is why I only let scientists in here once a year.
Oh,
no, I'm kidding. I love it.
So yeah, there's like dead things that can be a free food for lots of organisms out in the environment. So they do get cleaned up pretty quickly. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the main place that we encounter dead animals is usually through spying, roadkill. And yeah, that's what, and they're, you know, curbs and roads and things that are quite easily visible. We don't see the ones that are under shrubs and trees and stuff like that quickly get cleaned up.
Paul Dowdy, back on to my favourite. I love birds, but frogs. Most scientific labels can be pretty impenetrable to the layperson, but that's not the case when you're describing frogs. Run me through some of the names of some of the local WA frogs that people might hear and recognise.
Oh, well, there's the motorbike frog, Latoria mori. Do you want the Latin name as well?
Yes, please, sir.
So that is a large, over east they would call it a bell frog, or often the growling grass frog, because in that call you heard to begin the show, it kind of goes.
Okay, so we used to practice this as a kid and have a competition of who was better. So that's yours. Shall I give it a crack?
Yep.
Any good?
Yeah, it's pretty
right.
Good. The last bit, the brop. So that's over east. The frog, the bell frogs, that component is more exaggerated because that's why they call it the growling grass frog, because it goes.
Oh, I got to keep practicing that. Should we have a listen to the one I played earlier? Yours is definitely better than mine. You've been practicing though.
Yeah.
You're a proper frogger.
Some you can imitate relatively easy because it's more sort of in the human range, but some do all sorts of crazy clicks and stuff, and it's like, I can't do those, the clicky stuff.
What are some of the other common ones? I remember a slender tree frog at one point, but what are some of the other ones?
Well, you have the banjo frog, western banjo frog, which goes bonk, Limnodynastes dorsalis. One of the common ones is Crinia glauti, the rattling froglet. So we heard that one before. Super tiny. You'd rarely see it. So that's where the Frog ID app can come in handy, because good luck trying to see this thing, even if you're on your hands and knees going through the grass. But they're loud. They roar for their tiny size in frog terms.
There's one called the Shoemaker. How on earth did that get its name?
Well, it just sort of goes.
So the old sound of the shoemaker, which of course we don't see now because we just buy rubbish that we, you know, that we don't get fixed, do we? Okay, so that's the rationale. Okay, thank you for that, and also just helping me out on my motorbike frog calling, because that's something that I've spent my entire life trying to practice to outdo my siblings. So it's good that I'm getting a bit of, insider knowledge today. You're with Jess Strutt, ABC Radio Perth, the Focus program, talking today about citizen science. You don't need a Bachelor of Science and a lab coat to be a scientist. All you need these days is an interest in the natural world around you, and sometimes just a phone camera. And you can go out and help with amazing science research projects. Tegan, before we move on to look at another project that's going on nationally, how do you recruit people to your citizen science project with relating to birds?
Well, the great thing about birds is that there are people out there who do everything who do all sorts of things in their everyday life but also happen to have an interest in birds. And those people are already connecting with each other. Maybe they're members of BirdLife Australia, or they're bird photographers, or they are on Facebook groups or other parts of other networks. So for us, we communicate to people through all those networks, through all those ways that they're already engaged with the, like with their topic of interest, and ask for them to help out.
Does it take a bit of training though for recruits?
It depends. Some it does. So things like the great cocky count, you need to be able to identify a large black bird and be able to count is pretty much the requirements. But obviously some of our other projects do require some higher identification skills. So our bird data program, for example, can let anybody contribute bird sightings wherever they are, but they need to be able to identify them. We do provide little sort of ID tips and guides and things, particularly for things like our Aussie Backyard Bird Count. But I'm a little bit jealous of the Frog ID app, where you can just send a recording of a frog. And I know friends of mine do this, and they love it because they can go, oh, I think it's this or I think it's that. And somebody replies to them and says, oh, you're spot on, that's correct. Or, oh, did you hear there was this additional species calling in the background? And that's fantastic. That's like one of the great things about citizen science is it allows people to learn while they're out and about contributing to these bigger projects.
And that feedback must be critical, Paul.
Yeah, definitely. I think that sort of interaction with, in the case of the Frog ID app, it gets people to learn their local species. And I think that that connection with your local environment, our animal community, I think it's really important to sort of get to know these species, because I consider all the frog species my friends, and it's like, oh, there's my friend over there, and oh, that's that one there. And I think that's invaluable about how we can get communities switched onto our local environments, and that's the kind of gateway to conservation. We want to keep our friends around us. We want to keep these wetlands going so that we have birds and frogs in the future.
Let's move on to another citizen science project, a national one. It's called the Dead Tree Detective Project. Researches the mass tree deaths that occur across the country. And Belinda Medlin is involved with it. How does this project work, Belinda?
Oh, hi. So our project is a wee bit different from everyone else's so far, because we're actually asking people to record dead things instead of live things.
So we're not going to have to imitate a dead tree today.
Dead trees are pretty easy to imitate, actually, just not very interesting to listen to.
Yeah, that's right. Not good for radio. I've just got an invitation from the two scientists in here, and I tell you what, I'm going to get a picture and I'll tweet it out for everyone afterwards. Classic.
Fantastic.
Far away.
Yes. So our project is pretty simple. What we're trying to do is to track where trees have died across the country. So that kind of information isn't actually recorded anywhere. We discovered this because we are researching impacts of drought and heat waves on trees, and we're trying to predict where we think that trees might die from drought and heat waves. And we went looking for data to try and test whether we could actually predict this, and realised that there wasn't actually any information that was recorded. And what we did find was actually lots of reports from people, just ordinary people who might have seen something when they were out in a bushwalk, and maybe they'd written about it on their website, or, you know, they'd... there's an example from Cape York, where there was a big area of dieback in the mangroves, and the people who first saw it were tourist operators who were driving around and, you know, went back and said to the scientists, hey, we've seen this. And so a lot of those records are coming from citizen scientists already, but no one was really collecting them.
Right.
So the idea of our project is to provide a place where people who see dead trees and are a bit, you know, oh, that looks a bit odd, who do I tell, have a place to go and can put pictures up to show, you know, to record and track where and when trees have died.
So, Belinda Medlin, can anyone get involved?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyone at all. If they spot some dead trees around the place. So the way to do it, we don't have a fancy app. I also love the fancy Frog ID app, but we're part of the Atlas of Living Australia's BioCollect platform. And the way to find our website, we have an easy address, which is www.tinyurl.com/deadtreedetective, or else you just Google dead tree detective and you'll find it. And once you're on there, you upload your photograph and give some basic information about, you know, what are you actually seeing, how many trees are dead, how many trees are sick, how many trees are healthy, and is there anything obvious going on with the tree? And then, you know, leave it to us.
So what there must be heaps of benefits of having citizen scientists giving you this information. Are there any, does it add to any obstacles? I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of the amount of data that you're getting given, is that an obstacle?
That the more data, the better.
Okay, really? so you've got enough people to go through it and whatnot. I'm just sort of thinking in terms of data fatigue, getting enough time to analyse everything you're getting.
Yeah, so that is a problem. And we are doing everything we can to find funding and people to work on analysing these data. But there is a reasonably large community of researchers in Australia who are working on tree death. And so there's, you know, there's a number of people around the country who can use these data. So it's not, you know, it's not just me and my research group. There's people in every state who are working on tree dieback. So, you know, we will be able to make something of it all. And like I say, the more records, the better, the more information we have.
Belinda Medlin, the founder of Dead Tree Detective, thank you very much for your time. I've been asking you this morning, are you a citizen scientist? Plenty of texts coming through, and my apologies, it has taken a long time to get to them, but, you know, I've got a big panel today. Plenty to talk about. Justine says, I'm part of a fantastic whale monitoring research project in the southwest, tracking information about whales migrating past Geograph Bay, all volunteers, run by Chris Burton. It has been going since the 90s, and last year it counted over 5,000 humpbacks, as well as blue whales and southern rights. Justine, thanks for that. Gemma says, hey Jess, the Pauls 1 and 2 and Tegan, we used to catch tadpoles where I grew up in Meriden. Ah, Meriden, in the heart of the wheat belt. Gemma says she used to take them home. She'd watch them grow legs and turn into frogs and then put them back. Dad used to make a frog noise that went like this, to bob a bottle in a deep voice. Well, I'm not going to practice that. Do you know that one?
To bob a bottle?
I can't. I'm not going to. Oh, look, I think I've done enough frog impersonations for one day to my job's probably already on the line. So thanks for that, Gemma. Linda says another excellent citizen science app is the BirdLife Australia Bird Data, where you can record sightings of birds. There you go.
Absolutely.
Tegan's just throwing her hands up in the air. I thought you were doing another dead tree impersonation arms went up.
No, it's fantastic, and like, mobile technology has just really allowed people wherever they are in the country to contribute to citizen science projects. And yeah, the Bird Data app is one of those. And I mean, our smartphones do so much. They, you know, people bemoan the fact that nobody uses them to make calls anymore, but they have an inbuilt GPS. They have a camera, and the GPS in particular means we're a big country, and there's quite big parts of our country that don't have mobile phone reception, and some of those are the most interesting parts to visit. So we have the capacity to be recording information on the move and contributing to citizen science projects, even though we might be out of phone reception. And when we get back in reception, that little information burst just sends off to that project. It's fantastic.
Paul Flemons from the Australian Citizen Science Association. I just touched there on that idea of, I suppose, data fatigue, where you're almost overwhelmed with the information that citizens are providing. Does that happen often in terms of, you know, you need funding, I presume, to be able to go through this information, analyse it, for it to be meaningful?
Well, first up, I'd say you can never have too much data, really. And we're always seeking more citizen scientists to be involved in collecting data for us. But it is a challenge for big citizen science projects is being able to process the data. Frog ID, for example, all the data that is collected through the app by all the people around Australia, and that's 100,000 we've gone past now, all those records need to be identified by our expert team at the Australian Museum, which is quite a challenge, and as Paul, the other Paul, mentioned, Jody does go crazy. That's Jodie Rowley, our lead scientist on Frog ID. She does an amazing job on running the project from a scientific perspective, and she is across an enormous number of frog calls across Australia.
Sounds like someone I'm going to have to get in for another show on frogs the other day, and we can have a frog ribbit off or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, she does great impersonations. Thank you very much. She does great impersonations.
Let's go to a man who's just come up for a breath between dives to speak to us, to tell us about the project he's involved in. Morning, Paul Day.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks for coming up out of the water just for us.
Yeah, I tried to time it today so that we had an opportunity in between dives to be able to have a talk to you.
Thanks so much. Tell us about your project.
So I'm currently in Coral Bay with a group of volunteers that are working for the Reef Life Survey Foundation. And this is a foundation that was established just over 10 years ago now at the University of Tasmania. And it started off as an Australia-wide project and has in that 10 years has now become global. And we have surveys from 52 countries around the world engaging citizen scientists, but also engaging marine science students that are starting out their careers in science, and also professional scientists also conduct these surveys in their own time. And so, as you can imagine, we've now established, probably the largest reef fish data set in the world, and it's just fantastic. And, 99% of it's off of the back of, volunteers' contributions. So it's a fantastic program.
What has the data been able to show you anything so far that we didn't already know?
Yes, absolutely. We've been tracking the distribution of fishes along the west coast of Australia, for example. And I don't know whether you know about the marine heat wave that we had in 2010 and 2011.
Yes.
And we detected a very clear signal of community change in the composition of fishes at Rottnest Island, and some of the temperate fish that we were finding there frequently before the heat wave disappeared, and we detected that. But the good news is that continued monitoring by citizen scientists has actually it suggests that those fishes are coming back. So, yeah, it's a really important tool for monitoring the effects of climate change on particularly fish communities. So, yeah, and if the data we've been collecting feeds into local government management plans and numerous scientific publications and management reports, both at state and federal level. So, it's hugely important, and it would not be possible without the contribution of our volunteers.
Paul Day, thanks so much for calling in to tell us about your project with the Reef Life Survey Foundation. He's just literally popped up between dives there for us, so very kind of him to be part of our citizen science program today. You're with Jess Strutt on ABC Radio Perth. Paul Dowdy, what does it take to be a good frogger?
Well, you have to be prepared to go out at night and possibly get wet. These and possibly in the southwest here, be quite cold. So one thing with the Frog ID submissions is this time of year, WA goes off a bit because the frogs in the southwest are tied to our wet and cold Mediterranean climate. So this is the time for the frogs. If you go to your local wetland or park with a pond, there'll be frogs calling. So you have to be prepared to, go out after dark, be a bit cold, have a go. If you get rained on, have a laugh.
Tegan's probably going to say you'll stay dry if you go and look for birds. Is that right, Tegan?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you don't have to. You can go out at night and listen to owls and go out in the rain and go out on the ocean and all sorts of things. But one of the great attractions about being involved with bird research and just going out bird watching in general is it is such a fair weather occupation. If it's too hot, the birds won't be calling so much. If it's too windy or rainy, you might as well stay home and dry yourself. It's fantastic. Make the use of lovely weather conditions to go out and enjoy birds.
A couple of questions have come in on text, so I want to get to those. One for you, Paul Flemons, and I know it's without notice, so hopefully there is such a thing. Dennis wants to know, hi, ladies and gents, please direct me, I hope. Hi, ladies and gents, please direct me where and how to participate in soil microbiology identification as I work in horticulture. Is there such a thing?
I think there are a number of projects in that area. I'll direct him to the Australian Citizen Science Association website, and they've got a project finder there where you can, if you've got a particular interest or you're interested in a particular area or a particular type of citizen science project, you can search on the project finder website, which is actually run by the Atlas of Living Australia and the Australian Citizen Science Association together. And you can find it either going to the Atlas of Living Australia website or the association's website. And if you could put in soil and as a search term, you'll be able to find projects in that project finder that will tell you about soil projects. And I'm pretty sure there's one particularly around DNA, eDNA, where they get you to take samples of soil and send them in, and that will give a lot of information about the sorts of organisms that live in that soil. I can't recall the name of that project, but I'm pretty sure you'll be able to find it on Project Finder.
Dennis, Tegan's actually got some additional info as well for you.
Yeah, there certainly is. The name of the project has slipped my mind and I feel really bad because I know the woman that runs it. There's a project based at UWA that, does exactly as Paul was saying. It asks people to go out and collect soil samples from across the country, and they're looking at mapping the soil biodiversity across the country. And so, they've produced some amazing results so far, and they're still after samples from far and wide.
Dennis, why don't you send me a text saying that you're okay for me to pass on your details, and I'll do that. Tegan can remember the name of this group and you can get involved, because the whole point of today is, not just to hear people try and imitate a frog. It's actually to get people, loving nature and being involved, that the more we need it. I mean, we need it. Climate change is real, people. Just want to see if the text line starts up on that one. So, it's good to be involved in the natural environment and be across it. And one for you now, Paul Doughty. Mike from Maddington's called in. He heard a frog that sounded like a submarine sonar ping. Do you know what it is?
Like ding, 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 ding.
If he was at a wetland, it might actually not have been a frog, but it might have been a bird. It might have been a musk duck.
Wow.
The male musk duck has this really metallic-y call that it really doesn't sound like a bird, but they sit low in the water and they make this call and they splash at the same time, and I can't imitate it, but a submarine sonar sounds like a pretty accurate description.
Let's go with that.
Let's go with that, I reckon. Look, I could talk about this all day long, but unfortunately we've got to bring it to an end. My big thanks to Paul Doughty from the WA Museum. He's involved with Frog ID. And so get involved, download that app on your phone. Tegan Douglas from the WA Citizen Science Project Coordinator, and also from BirdLife Australia, and Paul Flemons from the Australian Citizen Science Association. A fantastic discussion. And I bet many of you now are racing out to your natural environment around you to get some pictures and record some sounds.